This is Mae Brussel. This is second half of World Watch's program number 824. Before I continue on Vanenu, maybe some of you new listeners want to know why I bring him up all the time and update you on this particular subject, and I will be writing a long article on this shortly, hopefully in October, maybe October, November. Mordecai Vanenu was arrested, kidnapped, in Italy, taken there as by a ruse by a woman associated, allegedly associated with the CIA, got him from London to Italy, where he was kidnapped, and taken to Israel, where he's having the most strict isolation and what you call a trial. He'll probably get life in prison if he isn't shot, for revealing that Israel has the neutron bomb. And I realized that when the explosion at Lake Cameron, on the lake in 1986 blew up, that the situation there was very similar to the neutron bomb, the way we've heard it described. In fact, the first clue I got was a person who came to the site and said, this looked like a neutron bomb. So I began to collect all the articles and scientific material I could on Cameroon, and Shimon Peres, the Prime Minister of Israel, arrived in Cameroon at the same time with a crew of 17 doctors that he hardly flies around with all the time, and they went to Cameroon while he visited with the new president. The president's been in there 2 years. It was a military coup, and instead of a native, well, the person there is very close to the Vatican. As a matter of fact, the military leader of Cameroon now invited the Pope there as soon as he was in power, and the Pope and the P2 and the Mafia and Steve Baum and the gun running and the terrorists and these kinds of activities that work very closely with Israel, such as slaying the people in Lebanon, giving the approval of our government, and working with the Italian government, had a pattern that looked as if Cameroon was a test case for the neutron bomb. And so I will be writing about it. I just want to share a couple more things about it. In the B'nai B'rith Messenger, September the 11th, there's an article about Vanenu's dad prays for his son. It's a large family, and he feels very badly about his son. The son had left the family and converted to Christianity and was very disappointed the way Israel conducts itself. He was disillusioned. And the article said, Vanenu's father turns to his recent visit to his son in a distant Israeli jail. He calls Mordecai, keeping quiet most of the time. When he did say something, it was complaints that the guards beat him. They want Modi to die and forget his memories, Mr. Vanenu said. His luck would only have him in trouble, and apparently it was decreed by the heavens that he would know no joy. The father felt so bad, that's what he was saying. The father said that he has little chance to forget his son's deeds because in Israel, this is what is happening to him. You'd think this was South Africa, not a religious country or whatever. He said he was beaten recently by neighborhood thugs who recognize him as the father of Israel's accused traitor. Otherwise, neighbors shun him. People jump on me as if I was the accused Nazi war criminal Don Demanjic. I don't know what I am accused of. What was my sin? People forget the obligation to respect an elderly man, and instead they torture me. The elderly Vanenu says that wherever he goes, people shun him. He has no friends. And he's the father of the person. He didn't know this was happening. He wasn't part of it. He didn't work with his son. But both of them are being abused and beaten, and the son talks about being beaten. The New York Times had a story September the 6th, 1987. In Cameroon, the press finds caution pays, and it tells about the sub-Sahara Africa's various countries. And while the press is generally free, the role of press in Cameroon isn't. And as I say, it's been with it is a military dictatorship, and their placards are saying, down with press censorship, we want free speech. And the article continues about sending different writers to jail. Two of them were sent to jail, and the president of Cameroon is very strict with them. In one of the quotations he said was, I'm in favor of censorship, not for the sake of censoring, but to make journalists responsible, to make them work for the common man, for the interest of the country. And working with under self-censorship system, the civil servants of the Information Ministry published the Cameroon Tribune, which is the dominant paper that runs about 65,000 copies. Last year, a government attempted to buy favorable coverage. A French journalist, Jacques Tillier, acknowledged that the Cameroon government had regularly paid him about $30,000 every 3 months since 1985 to write favorable articles on Cameroon. If you wonder why you're not getting much coverage, last June, this is the 1986, and remember, this is, you know, at the trial at the time of just around the explosion, shortly before the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir visited here, and Shimon Peres was the first one, then Yitzhak Shamir, Cameroon officials met with local reporters who were to attend a news conference that Shamir was to give. The purpose was to assign individual reporters to ask questions prepared for it in advance by the government. So there is Israel, protected by the president of Cameroon, and just as Vanunu is secreted away, the press can't ask any Israeli questions. Even if they wanted to, they'd probably be lined up and shot. And then in these times, at an article just recently by Diana Johnstone, she's a fairly good writer and researcher, does a good job, called France, West Germany, and the Neutron Bomb Diplomacy. And this again goes into the candidates that want the neutron bomb, and particularly there was push by former President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, and in that era it was William Casey and Alexander Haig that were pushing the neutron bomb in Europe to be deployed. This was before Mitterrand was in, and this is about the neutron bomb diplomacy and this nice weapon, these nuclear weapons, if they're outdated, use the neutron bomb, because then you just get rid of people and animals, and you have all the resources of factories and the various cathedrals and museums. The people are out of the way very quickly, and everything they had belongs to you. It's an absolutely perfect weapon. I think AIDS is the second best weapon. Neutron bomb is first, and can be used selectively in both cases. Now, I get a lot of letters from people who particularly appreciate my giving sources of books and sources of information, such as Covert Action, or publications like In These Times or Guardian or Central American Papers, and things that they wouldn't be turned on to any otherwise, and that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I just want to tell you that there is it's called a film festival, the Home Film Festival. I don't know how many of you like foreign films, but there's documentaries and very valuable films, and I consider most of the foreign films to be like attending a play. Home Film Festival has video cassettes, and you rent them by mail. They mail them to you, and they have the label and the stamp. You keep them 3 days and mail it back after 3 days, and you just put it in the same box it came in, put a label over your label, and you don't have to go down to a video store, and it's on its way. And I'm going to give you the phone number, toll-free number, to call them, 1-800-258-FILM. This is in Pennsylvania. Or you can write P.O. Box 2032, Scranton, Pennsylvania, 18501. Now, the first film I wanted was Sorrow and the Pity, which was just amazing. The membership for the film festival is $25, and they send you a book of 60 pages, and then they update it with every picture you get or every month. So I already have almost 100 pages of films, and you can order them as often as you want. There's no minimum, no maximum. And they have a plan that you can order 1 a week, 2 a week, 3, and they just come regularly. You don't have to place your order, and you can say whether you want them to come on a Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, or the weekend. So I worked out myself arrangement. I listed 20 movies, and another one came in Ingmar Bergman last week, and next week it's going to be The Serpent Egg. Now, that's Serpent's Egg. That's an Ingmar Bergman movie that I talked about for years on the radio, and many of you don't know the name. And I tried to get our local theater where they have these types of films and was told it wasn't available. There was going to be a fundraising for Kazoo, and they wanted if I'd speak. And I said, if you get The Serpent's Egg. Then we had a Monterey Film Festival, and they wanted suggestions for an old movie. And they had some very good political movies. And I said, Serpent's Egg, no, we can't get The Serpent's Egg. And we have a Monterey Institute where they have two foreign films each week. And I try to get there at least once a week. And I asked, any requests? I write down Serpent's Egg. No, you can't get it. Well, this film society has it, and I recommend that you get it and watch it. And you might share with me things that you've ordered that I don't know about, and I'll update some for you. if some of you want to. There's a lot of documentaries and a whole list of them, and some that you missed, I've missed, some we want to see again. And it's very, very valuable to, I think, to belong to this collection. I'm just really thrilled that it exists, to friends in the Carmel area who belong, World Watchers, and friends told me about it. So I recommend that you send for this and use your own taste and choice, and then pass on to other people what they can learn from this instead of all the junky television that's around. As a matter of fact, where we live, the cable system just put in a whole new system with all the different channels going up to 30 or 40 in home box office and the entertainment stations. And I had them in for 1 week, and they came this morning and moved everything out. I don't want it. I'll take C-SPAN, CNN, just the basic 13 channels, and get these movies from Pennsylvania, because that's a much more intelligent way to not waste your time, but to learn and enjoy and drink in some of these feelings and attitudes from different countries. Now, in terms of the Italian article that was in about Italy, the Washington Post, that was sent around the country, the plans to kill Ronald Reagan, I have done broadcasts on the incidences that suggest that Reagan might be in trouble. The helicopter exchange in going to his home up in Santa Barbara, the articles about him that suggested that he was ready to retire, that he's impotent, and indications that he's now expendable. Also, the martial law plan and Jack Terrell, the article about Jack Terrell and how he's interviewed by the FBI on the plot to kill Ronald Reagan. I had that on program 818. And trying to frighten Reagan, program number 820, the National Security Council with Jose Sorzano and Elliot Abrams and the others, sending him messages that may make him at least scared to change his policies because of the dangers that he was around at this time. Now, Lou Cannon is the White House correspondent for Washington Post and the various newspapers syndicated, and he has an article in the LA Herald, September 14th, 1987, titled "Swan Song Agenda, No More Weed Studies, Luxury Condos." And this has to do with Ronald Reagan's wanting to be remembered for some very important things, so he's not going to waste money picking on the welfare state and money sent to study weeds or buying suits for undertakers in Greece and all the dumb things he talks about. And he sort of, according to this article or this resume, you can get the collected works of Ronald Reagan in a 13-minute speech he gave to the White House that week of the September 14th. But he's mainly going into the Contras and Bork. That's his big shtick, to get those accomplished, to fund the Contras, hopefully to overthrow Nicaragua and get Bork on the Supreme Court. But then Lou Cannon, who knows Reagan as well as just about anybody who follows him, said, "But Reagan is no longer as keen as he used to be, even with a script, and his aides dare not expose him to a news conference. Last week, Reagan repeatedly fumbled his lines, once saying that his administration had, in quotes, more than 6 years behind us and just six more months to go." And he made notice that the curtain call is 16 months, but Reagan is a performer who can't remember his lines. Now, the Kansas City Times article that was sent to me by Donald Call said maybe this Reagan slip wasn't a slip at all. And this article said there was a little noticed item in the news the other day that just might possibly be the most sensational political story of the decade. And remember the article I cited from the Washington Post, September 8th and 9th, where particularly the one on the 9th, saying that the story in Italy, this current Iran gate scam in Italy, could turn half of Italy upside down. And those people are closely related to the Reagan administration. This article says, "When Reagan returned from his vacation this week, he announced his agenda for the rest of his term in office: support the Contras, confirm Bork, and on the Supreme Court. But he said one other very interesting thing that didn't get a lot of attention. He said he hoped to get those things accomplished in the remaining 6 months of his term. Perhaps it was a misstatement, but what if the president meant it? What if he's planning to resign in his office in 6 months?" So going back to broadcast 820 on August 24th, I cited in quite length and detail the plans to frighten Ronald Reagan and also the connections of Reagan to the terrorists in the Middle East and Henry R. Sand and the Rosano Brazzi, part of that whole operation, Reagan and Frank Sinatra, the connections of these people in this administration to what's going on in Europe right now. Now, a gentleman who I mentioned was interviewed by the FBI and pressured as possible fall guy for the Reagan assassination story if it happened, and this was in 1986. He has an article in the San Francisco Examiner, September the 12th. Ex-Contra supporter says, North tried to discredit me. Oliver North last year orchestrated an effort to discredit Jack Turrell as one of the first to link North to a secret Contra aid network. He claimed that Turrell was a Nicaraguan spy plotting to assassinate Ronald Reagan. And here is North, who works with George Abbas, Abu Nidal, Abbas, Hadass. He's working with all these, Assad rather, the three of them are a little bit confusing, but not really. The terrorist group that Oliver North bought his weapons from for the Contras came out of this terrorist group, the same group that's linked to the plot they had to kill Reagan. This article says Terrell is now assisting the investigation of alleged Contra drug and gun smuggling. He's also working with Peter Del Scott and the Christic Institute. The Congressional Iran-Contra panel this week released censored copies of Oliver North's memos to President Reagan regarding Terrell and a Justice Department report on the FBI investigation. Now, did North send memos to President that Terrell was being asked about plans to kill Ronald Reagan? The article goes on, former National Security Advisor John Poindexter told the Iran-Contra panel in closed-door testimony this year that he showed Reagan memos from Oliver North outlining the charges against Terrell, a former paramilitary supporter of the Contras who later had a falling out with the rebel leadership. However, Reagan apparently was never told by the FBI or Secret Service later that they cleared Terrell after subjecting him to lie detector tests for 2 days. Think of the implications here of telling a man who possibly may be killed by a former, in quotes, Contra, who then would be framed, just as after John Kennedy was killed, the FBI said, oh, we had reports that he knew about it and had notified the FBI a week or 2 weeks in advance that John Kennedy was going to be killed in Dallas. But the reason the Secret Service and the FBI didn't tell Ronald Reagan that Terrell was cleared was that they could always use it on the records later. Yes, we had word that he planned to kill Reagan, and they could pull a Lee Harvey Oswald at the same time. And the article says, Terrell said, I've done a lot of crazy things in my life, but never against my country. What they were trying to do was damage control, said Terrell, who was never charged with any crime. A July 17, 1986 memo from North to Poindexter titled Terrorist Threat, Terrell, states that an unnamed security officer for North's Project Democracy evaluated Terrell as extremely dangerous, possibly working for the security services of another country. This is like Theodore Shackley and Michael Ledeen and Frank Turpel working and shaping the script and the lies, along with Claire Sterling and Paul Hentze of the CIA, that the KGB and the Bulgarians tried to shoot the Pope, all of the Iran-Contra team coming from that group. So they have the record that he may have worked for another country. And the article continues, the FBI now believes that Terrell may well have been a paid asset of the Nicaraguan Intelligence Service or another hostile security service, North memo said. So this team not only planned to kill Mr. Sims, the ambassador to Costa Rica, who used to be in Colombia, to blame Nicaragua, to invade Nicaragua, but they were creating this Terrell story. And when Reagan survived the summit, I had mentioned on the air several times that it would be hard to do the assassination after the Christic Institute filed their suit May 29, 1986. And all of these people involved with this White House secret team and the National Security Council and the Defense Department would be linked to the assassination of Ronald Reagan if it had taken place, because they were identified in the Christic Institute. So then North can tell Poindexter to tell the president, here are these people, so that they couldn't go through with it then, but if there was another attempt to kill Reagan or to scare him, they could pull out the record. We told you we thought he was involved in gun running and drug smuggling, and so that he would be smeared, this Tom Posey from Civilian Military Assistance that's based in the South, I believe Alabama, Southern Base Paramilitary Group, was the ones that were supposed to be investigating Terrell and feeding this information. You've seen Tom Posey on the news a lot of times. So Poindexter is telling Reagan in July 28th, which is 2 months after the Christic Institute is filed and 1 month after the plot to kill him in Venice, which was obviously called off. The article says Poindexter's memo also said that the FBI reports that Terrell went to Miami, coincident with your visit on Wednesday. The FBI, in concert with the Secret Service, has Terrell under active surveillance. Like James Hostie of the FBI was following Oswald and was out at Irving, Texas, talking to his wife and leaving his name and the license number of his car, and it was identifiable. And with Mrs. Payne, Terrell, using the alias, this was their report, Colonel Flacco, was once the inner circle of Contra Military Chief Enrique Bermudez and CMA paramilitary group. He helped plan and boarded November 84 CMA strike into Nicaragua. But Terrell said he was shut out of the aid network because he refused to go along with a plan to kill Eden Pastora. And again, these deaths come up all the time, and I'm spending a lot of time on this. It's so important to see how many people these people wanted to kill, and by the grace of God, whether it was Khomeini or Gaddafi or Sims or Pastora, there is, maybe it's the year of the convergence or whatever, or it was preceding with a little slow motion, because the Pastora is helping the Christic Institute, as is Terrell, and are identifying the people who really had killed 7 journalists and attempted to kill Pastora and 2 of the plaintiffs with the Christic Institute. So he left the group because they wanted to kill Pastora, and they were doing illegal gun running. And Tom Posey, the CMA's leader, has vigorously denied Terrell's accusations. Terrell said his only contact with the Nicaraguan embassy was to infiltrate the Sandinista government at one time and pass himself as a disaffected Contra. He resurfaced again in 1986 as a witness for Kerry. He also cited a lawsuit brought by, they say, the Liberal Christic Institute, which accords C-Court and others accused them of illegal drug and gun running. So this is the story of trying to blame and having somebody to blame if everything was according to what the plans were later. And maybe it's possible that, not being able to pull that off, they're getting ready for Reagan to resign and get George Bush in because of George's close proximity to El Salvador, to the death squads, the former director of the CIA, and Mr. Gomez-Rodriguez. George Bush is up to his ears in this entire story, his aides and so forth. So maybe Bush couldn't get elected, but you would need a companion to the secret team, just as when Nixon was out at Watergate, he brought in Gerald Ford, who he appointed on the Warren Commission. Now, the Washington Post has a long article Sunday, September the 6th. It's going to take me about 6 or 7 hours to outline it. It's so long. I'm just going to cite it to you, so if you want to go to the library, you can get it. Written by Dan Morgan and Walter Pincus, titled, Are Deeper Secrets Still Being Hidden? And it may be those deep secrets and the drug money and the mafia money and the kill money in the banks of Mr. Willard Zucker with Mr. Albert Hakim and C-Court and the National Security Council. As I say, this is Reagan's tar baby. He's really stuck up to his fingers. And this article is filled with many, many pages. It's actually 4 full newspaper-sized pages, and it goes into problems that have not been opened up, the profits, the unraveling of the story, the use of William Casey's secret network and the Defense Department and the Enterprise. As I say, if you copy it at the library, take a lot of dimes. It's a long article, and I will outline it for you. The Enterprise's unspent millions, and it's got Mr. Amir Nir, the Israeli connections, and it goes on and on. I'll share it with you later, but if you want to read it now, it's very long, and it brings up questions, and there are so many questions. If you just go through the World Watches for the past 5 years, you could ask those questions for the answer to the Iran-Contra story. but there are deep secrets. And then, of course, Bush is sitting there waiting. If Reagan resigns, he couldn't get elected, but not wanting a new team that hasn't been up to their ears with this for a long, long time. You wouldn't want Jack Kemp or even Mr. Senator Dole or Pat Robertson, who the Republicans going to put in, that could cover the secret so well as George Bush. September the 9th, New York Times has a long story. Bush advisor said to no in 1986 of North deals. And, of course, North was working with Donald P. Gregg, the NSC assistant to George Bush, and a lot of stories are coming out. And, of course, George Bush was meeting with Mr. Gomez Rodriguez on the arms deals. The Wall Street Journal has a story, September the 14th, 1987, Politics and Policy. Bush, blue blood, Texas oil man, Washingtonian, still must confront the question, who are you? We'll start with the order of the death head at Yale. That's a good starting point, digging up the grave, allegedly digging up Geronimo, the Indian chief. Who are you? This is the first part of a series dated September the 14th on Bush. And then the long article in the Washington Post, September the 9th, the same day that this long article was in about the Iran connections to the mafia and the drug running in Italy, the arms to Iran, $3 million worth of mines, with the connection and approval, of course, with the United States government. The Washington Post story is titled, Key Memo Raises New Questions, 1986 Note to Bush Mentioned the Resupply of the Contras. So that would be a very good time to put Bush in if Reagan decides to step down in 6 months. Now, there's an article in the New York Times, August the 7th, about G. Gordon Liddy, and it has to do with his speech-making. The article says Henry Kissinger gets $20,000 a lecture. G. Gordon Liddy of Watergate makes $1.5 million a year, and he lectures four times a week at $7,500. And the gist of the article is Oliver North could make about anything he wanted. He could name his price. Now, a listener to World Watchers brought me Newsday, Friday, August 21st. Watergate caper helps a TV career. And it's about G. Gordon Liddy, but it goes on, and he's in a TV movie for NBC. Of course, Henry Kissinger is on the board or in charge. That's another close contact, the major media. Liddy said, I've been on the other end of the talk show so much, it would be about time that he played another part other than a villain, he said. Liddy said he was consulted so often during the recent Iran scam hearings that they actually put a satellite uplink in my driveway and took turns talking to me. Now, G. Gordon Liddy was a partner with the Deputy Attorney General Robert Mardian at the time of Watergate. The attorney for Robert Mardian was this Robert Greene, who was close to General Secord. He's his attorney and close to Oliver North and Fawn Hall. And Mardian and Liddy used to go down to the basement of the archives to watch Nazi Gestapo movies. Now, G. Gordon Liddy, who is close to the entire Iran-Contra group because the team's been in there a long time, is best described in the book The Secret Agenda, Watergate, Deep Throat, the CIA by Jim Hogan, the same gentleman who wrote Spooks, published in Random House in 1984. And I'll conclude this broadcast, if I can, quickly get in Chapter 2 called The Odessa, The Plumbers Get to Work, and it tells about E. Howard Hunt in the spring of 1971, calling in the former Bay of Pigs operations. Of course, a lot of them are the gist of the entire Christic Institute groundwork for what went on later, and he's telling about his work with the teams that were so-called plumbers in the White House. This was a special unit to be called the Plumbers, assigned to stop leaks. That was the cover to stop leaks out of the Treasury Department. Immediately when G. Gordon Liddy was with that group, with Egil Crow, working on narcotics matters, and you see how that works, he imposed his peculiar imagination on the plumbers. He created a sensitivity indicator to distinguish our product from that of other agencies that were coordinating White House sources. Our organization was directed to eliminate subversion of secrets of the administration. And that was important. I created an acronym for it. The acronym appealed to me because when I organize, I'm inclined to think in German terms. And the acronym was also used by World War II German veteran organization, still is, belonged to by acquaintances of mine, the Odessa, the Organisation der Emmerlingen Schutzstaffel Angerbrogen. on the blackboard in German for clarity and added security, I diagrammed a new Odessa organization. The only exception to the German was the use, common in the Nixon White House, of the Greek letters and mathematical symbol pi as a symbol for the president. I'll do more next week because my time is out. I just have to pick up there about the German veteran organization, the Nazis, that G. Gordon Liddy worked with, and his importance with the Iran-Contra story, because it does go back to fascists and Nazis, and until they unravel that background, we still don't have the basis for how these people got together. But unfortunately, I have to leave in the middle of the Odessa part. I'll be back with you next week. This is Mae Brussel, and I'm going to pick that up from there, because that's the part missing out of the Iran-Contra story, just as it was out of the Warren Report and many other investigations.